I got cancer. I got cancer. I'm part of the statistical demographic that ends up getting cancer. They put me in a machine today. They're gonna blast me with a radiation ray. It's gonna burn my lymph nodes away. I hope I don't need them. Don't even know what a lymph node is for, but I'm gonna have to send it out the door. Cause I got cancer, 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 cancer. Yeah.
Hello, friends, and thank you for tuning into the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. If this is the first time that you've listened to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, I'd like to personally climb into your pocket and nestle into the inner folds of your back pocket and sleep there for a while and dream with you. I would like to entwine momentarily with you and your dreams and go to a place where we could sit together in some grass-covered field and stare out at some beautiful alien sunset with three incredible burning stars in the sky and strange hoofed tentacle creatures that dance in front of us with little tambourines and pipes filled with an herb that smells like the underbelly of caterpillars harvested in the dark lands that H.P. Lovecraft wrote about in his incredible book, The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath. If I could, that's what I'd do. And I would look at you and you would look at me and I would try to make you understand how absolutely improbable it is that at this very moment you have allowed my raspy lesbian voice to go spilling into the inner parts of your ears and trigger the part of your brain that transforms sound vibrations into human speech. What a mess we've gotten into, I'd say to you. What is this? How did you let me shrink and get into your pocket and take you to this weird place? I don't know how to get out of here. And we would stay there, stuck in that place for a million years, gradually being born and dying and born again, always to the same mother, but not a human mother, an enormous fat larva thing with 7,000 dilated eyeballs and fanged teeth. And every time we found ourselves ejected from her alien vagina, she would devour us and inject us again over and over and over again with a increase in the acceleration, an increase in temporal velocity until our births and deaths had sped up to a kind of strobe light rapidity until at last we separated once again and returned to our roles, you as the person tuning in to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour and me as the person called Duncan Trussell babbling into a microphone somewhere in Los Angeles on a Friday. Hello. I'm very excited about this podcast. It's one of my top three favorite that I've ever done. I have a giddy feeling of trepidation, similar to the way a 60s member of the Weather Underground might have felt prior to dumping a barrel full of LSD into the New York City water supply. This is a good one. But before we get going, let's do a little business. If there ever was a time to support the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, this is it. I've got to pay off these doctors for irradiating my lymph nodes, and the shit ain't cheap. So, if you've held off for whatever terrible reason from supporting this podcast, why not go to DuncanTrussell.com and buy one of our t-shirts or one of our amazing posters? Or if you really want to go crazy, donate a little money through our PayPal link. Every single amount counts, and if every single one of you would just donate $2, not only would I be able to completely pay off all of my medical bills or my insurance deductibles, I would also be able to get breast implants. So why not do it? Go to DuncanTrussell.com, support the podcast. If you don't feel like doing that, you can support the podcast by going to Amazon, going through our Amazon portal, which is at DuncanTrussell.com. Anytime you buy something on Amazon, we get a percentage of that. And you can also support the podcast by going to audibletrial.com/family hour and signing up for a trial membership. They give us $15 when anybody does that. And audiobooks are incredible. I'm sure many of you remember those wonderful days of childhood when you used to dress in your grandmother's clothes and your mom would lotion your feet while she read stories to you. God, what wonderful days. Well, you can bring those days back just by going to audibletrial.com/family hour and signing up for a trial membership. You get a free audiobook. And if you want, you can cancel, if you want to be a bandit, you can cancel the membership and keep the audiobook, which is a pretty good deal. And it's a way for you to support this podcast. We're also sponsored by ShoreDesignT-Shirts.com. Why not go to ShoreDesignT-Shirts.com and check out their amazingly soft, vulva-level soft shirts that feel so good wrapped around your poor, stinging meat body. If you go to ShoreDesignT-Shirts.com and order one of those shirts and put my name in, you get 10% off. Okay. As many of you know, from time to time, I will talk about Aleister Crowley. Aleister Crowley was perhaps the greatest occultist that ever lived. He was a mystic, a magician, a philosopher, and a mountain climber. A very interesting human who had a profound impact on our society, and who has always captured my attention and my imagination, and is someone that I've had a lot of curiosity about and a lot of questions about. And so I've wanted to, for some time, to get someone on this podcast who would be able to answer my questions about Aleister Crowley, the great beast 666. And thanks to Matt Staggs over at disinfo.com, I was connected with James Wasserman. James Wasserman is a writer. He is a publisher. He has published many books on the occult, including the Simon Necronomicon, as well as his own autobiography called In the Center of the Fire. He's also had the association of some of the greatest occultists of our time, including Marcelo Ramos Mata, as well as Alejandro Jodorowsky, the filmmaker who, among many films, made The Holy Mountain, which is an incredible movie, incredible psychedelic, esoteric movie that you must watch if you haven't watched. Wasserman is an expert in the occult, and I was thrilled to get a chance to talk to him. I was moved by this interview. I learned a lot from it. So everyone, please welcome and send your psychic tendrils out to New York to embrace the great magician, the wonderful soul, that is James Wasserman. Okay. Hi, Jim. Thank you so much for appearing on the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. Thank you for being here.
I really appreciate your inviting me, Duncan. This is quite an honor for me.
Thank you. I have so many questions for you that I don't think we're going to be able to cover them in the span of an hour, but maybe we can. Just to give you a little background on me, I have been fascinated with the occult for pretty much my whole life. And interestingly enough, one of my first encounters with it was the Simon Necronomicon.
Is that so?
Absolutely, yep. And I can remember buying that at Walden Books was the name of the bookstore. I don't think that bookstore exists anymore, but I remember buying that and having just this rush of exhilaration when I was a kid. I felt like so secret and dark, and I would study that in my room, and my parents were worried. And I think I even went out in the woods and tried to do a ritual from it when I was a kid. This is when I was in high school. Nothing really happened. I got mud on my pants.
Yeah, I know the feeling. That was my first book in Studio 31. That was the book that kicked off my business.
Well, I mean, it's still out there. That's an immensely popular book, isn't it?
It sure is. We just did a beautiful hardcover reprint, a 31st anniversary edition, both in cloth bound and a leather bound, signed by Simon, and really a beautiful, beautiful production. So, yeah, it's exciting.
My first question for you is how would you define magic?
Well, I would defer to Aleister Crowley on that. And, you know, he defined magic as the science and art of causing change to occur at will. And, you know, it's a matter of what kind of change you intend to create. And, you know, in Crowley's teaching, he discussed something that he called the true will. And that true will is the purpose of your incarnation. It's like the secret code of what it is that you're supposed to do in life, and how you're supposed to leave the world different than you found it. And what we say and what we interpret Crowley to have said is that the use of magic is to make oneself an engine for the pursuit of the true will, so that our purpose is to discover and to do the true will, and magic helps us do both. It's something that it's a way of life. It's a spiritual path. And there are different kinds of there are different aspects to magic. There's invocation, there's evocation, there's... Crowley really made a huge imprint on the study of magic when he introduced Eastern techniques of meditation and concentration in order to empower the magician to, have a stronger and more powerful engine by which he could, pursue his will. So it's a rather all-encompassing subject magic is, and as I say, it is a way of life.
The Crowley in book four, in the very beginning, it seems like the advice in the very beginning is to strengthen your focus. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And, you know, as you recall in the in Magic and Theory and Practice in Book 4, Part 3, what Crowley does is he talks about magic being a part of the life of a banker, a boxer, an electrician. In other words, this is something that we do in all of our life's work. It's not only what occurs in a temple, wearing ceremonial robes, burning, incense and lighting candles. Magic is a pursuit of the true will. It's a pursuit of what Crowley called the holy guardian angel. And primarily doing the purpose for which you were born on this earth.
This brings me into a question that I've wondered about, and I kind of think about it in a Zen koan sort of way, which is the phrase, "Do as thou will shall be the whole of the law. Love is the law, love under will." Did I say that right?
No, very, very close, though. It's "do what thou will what? Shall be the whole of the law. Love is the law, love under will."
Do what thou will.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I think people hear that, and this is kind of why Crowley is so notorious, is because people misinterpret that, I think. Because people hear that and they think, "I'm going to do heroin." All right, I'm going to You know, it seems like it's a kind of hedonistic prescription. And I think people misinterpret that because they don't understand that the idea of the true will is much deeper than sense gratification. Is that fair to say?
Pardon me?
Is that fair to say?
Oh, you could not be more correct. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law has been so thoroughly misinterpreted as a formula of hedonism, as a formula of crime, as a formula of all kinds of misbehavior. Crowley called it, in Magic and Theory and Practice, the most austere ethical precept ever uttered to man. He really, if one understands the concept of the true will, it's like a tremendous task. You know, your responsibility or our responsibility is to constantly attempt to adjust and refine our behavior in such a way that we do the one purpose at the exact time, you know, for which we're here. In other words, you know, right now, I really believe it is my true will to be speaking with you. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be doing it.
Right. You know?
And if I did do it because of personal weakness, or social pressure or something, or a desire for grandiosity, if those were my motivations, I would be a failure at it, you know, because the only thing I can be successful at doing is that for which I am, you know, called to do. I'm a servant, and I'm a servant of a greater whole, and that greater whole is what I call my holy guardian angel. It's something that, or someone, or who knows what the heck it is, but it's a higher power to which I am directly responsible, and for which, you know, I live in service to that ethic. I mean, it's a whole point. And that's why I say to you, you know, again and again in the few minutes that we've been talking, is that magic is a way of life. It's not just what happens when you're, you know, prancing around the magical circle. A lot of people, especially people that are new to it, you know, feel that that's, they're doing magic, and then they're going out and they're doing their business, and they're working in their marriage or their relationship, and every one of those things is different. As you pursue the path for longer periods of time, everything is united. My career, my marriage, my children, my books, my daily prayers, my motions, my interaction with neighbors, everything I try to dedicate and devote toward my true will. Now, of course, obviously, my friend, I'm not always successful. But I do the best I can.
Well, this concept of the true will, it reminds me of the verse in the Bhagavad Gita. I don't remember the verse, which is, it's better to be an honest street sweeper than a dishonest king, and that it's very dangerous to follow another person's path, and that you should only be on your own path. But I think that there is it's such a terrifying idea to consider, because I think a great many people, probably most people, are not enacting their true will at all, because it takes a lot of courage to really recognize what it is that you want to do.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that Crowley is so controversial, because he demanded that each one of us be a fully responsible star, you know, a fully responsible being. He said it in one of his publications, There Is No God But Man, you know, and that's such a profoundly important statement. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of smaller minded people will say something like, well, if there's no God but man, I guess that means that, you know, we can do whatever we want and be atheists or something. And I say the opposite. I say, you know, if there is no God but man, it means that man is God. And if that's the case, we need to act like gods, not like you know, sense gratifying, self-indulgent, you know, losers who are running around the planet, you know, filling themselves with all kinds of false promises and worshiping all kinds of false idols.
And I guess that brings us to the second part, which is love is the law, love under will. Can you explain what that means? That's the part that is the most perplexing to me in a good way.
Well, you know, that's where Crowley becomes, I think, you know, the most almost mysterious, in the sense that, you know, what he's really talking about, and in my understanding at least, is the Bodhisattva vow, where you swear not to achieve personal liberation for yourself until every blade of grass is ready for the enlightenment with us. And, you know, the idea of love is the law, love under will, means that I can't, you know, if I think that doing what I will shall be the whole of the law, I can't, obviously, I can't hurt you in the process. I mean, if you're trying to hurt me, yes, in self-defense, I can do whatever I need to, but that's not the point. In that case, I would be loving you interacting with you in a relationship that was that which you demanded of me was, you know, to be shot or something. I mean, right. You know, but what we're really talking about here is an ethical code that, you know, seeks to encompass all of mankind in the most positive and profound manner, you know. And people have misunderstood that one too, as if it's some sort of, you know, called, I've heard misinterpretations that range as far as rape, you know, as justifiable use of love is the law, love under will. You know, that's so asinine and distorted. I stand in awe behind anyone who would think such lunacy. In reality, what we're talking about is an interaction with all of mankind and in fact with all of life that expands ever outward to a higher and higher and higher plane of becoming.
Wow. That is beautiful. And I think, yes, I think what you're saying is definitely, when people think of magic, they think of people spray painting Satan on the wall of abandoned houses. They don't, and when they think of Aleister Crowley, they have a kind of sinister idea, and they don't. And honestly, when I first started studying him, that was the idea that I had. You know, the notorious beast 666, this kind of madman who was dangerous. And then more and more, the more I read, the more I began to see, oh, this seems to be a kind of loving being who is expressing a transcendent idea using symbols that, for whatever reason, have been obscured from society in a way that other religions are less secretive. And it seems like the source of a lot of his information is more shadowy or more difficult to pin down. I don't understand where a lot of it's coming from. And I think maybe you could even say that his stuff is, though all religion and all mysticism is easy to misinterpret, it seems like a lot of what he wrote about is so confusing and complex and mind-bending that when I've tried to understand it, and I want to get more into the Thoth Tara specifically, I just give up in the way that when I'm trying to read Heidegger or trying to understand calculus, it's so complex.
Well, he was, first place, he was a brilliant, brilliant mind. And I've been studying him for, really over 40 years. And, if I actually was counting, it's probably 45 or something. And, the fact of the matter is that I've never even come close to understanding him, or being able to match him in intelligence. And it's one of the reasons I continue to study him, because I'm constantly learning something new, and he's constantly pointing me in new directions and new courses of study and trying to acquire, the information to be, to be able to match myself better against his intellect. And, it's been a lifetime process. And, as far as where, how he got his information, I think he was, truly a master. I mean, I think he received inspiration and knowledge from the universal source, and was a voice and a medium for that higher intelligence that is running life on Earth, and we're attempting to communicate with it and to be in harmony with it, and you mentioned that Tarot, it's that's one way of entering into communication, and meditation is another way of entering into communication with that higher force, and ritual invocation is a profoundly important way of doing that as well, so that we're constantly seeking a higher knowledge. And And, in a way, by, bending our minds to try to understand the brilliance of Crowley's mind, it's just a foreshadowing of reaching the point where we're actually able to, understand more of the divine mind, which he was also struggling to understand for his entire life. So, it's like a chain, and it's a chain of ever-expanding consciousness, and we are where we are, each one of us as individuals, and that's what we do. We just try to go from where we start and go further and further.
There's a, when you talk about this ever-expanding consciousness, it seems that, I believe Crowley wrote about this, though I can't remember where, but it seems that there's a point as consciousness expands where you get so close to that higher intelligence that a merging happens. And after the merging happens, it seems as though there's some kind of, I don't want to say danger, but there's some kind of threat to the ego structure that happens, or a kind of surrender, a kind of ego death that has to happen. Can you talk a little bit about that? The idea that there is in other religions, when you hear in Zen, I suppose there's a form of danger involved, and that you can go a little crazy in Zen. But in a lot of other religions and philosophies, there's not as much of this sense of danger. Is why does there seem to be something dangerous associated with magic or with Crowley's philosophy, or is that just in my head?
No, I don't think it's in your head at all. I think it's definitely part of, you know, of his teaching. And, you know, it's very hard. When you, first place, you know, we start out as these sort of little people. I mean, you know, you start out with your mother and father. They tell you what to do. They feed you. They change your diapers. I mean, there's this whole sense of we're born into the world as powerless beings. You know, we're born into the world as helpless and dependent. And what Crowley's basically saying to us is, you know, become as a god. You know, you will be, you know, directing the course of the heavens. You know, it's very much the law of Thelema or the teaching of do what thou wilt, to me, seems to have some strong, really recognizable roots in the Egyptian system and religion, because those folks were really, their goal was to be at one with the gods, to be sitting around tables with them in the afterlife, and to be playing, you know, board games, and to be eating and drinking and making love and doing all of the things that the gods themselves do. He or she was received as one of their number, you know. It's very different than the Christian or Jewish concept, where there's a, let's say there's a God on top who's in charge of everything, and he's like this father, and, you know, you're the eternal child, and, you know, you can become closer to daddy or something, but you're always going to be in a dependent relationship. What Crowley was trying to teach, in my opinion at least, is that you know, you become the equal of you know, your heavenly father.
Yes, and that is terrifying to a lot of people. That's a terrifying idea. It's too empowering. It's too much. It brings to mind, you know, Icarus burning up and falling into the sea, or this kind of like human hubris, where to try to attain that level is not just foolish, but somehow dangerous, and goes against this idea of being this kind of devoted servant to the force of life in the universe, whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely, and that's where I think the danger is.
Yes,
you know, it's a very real danger, because, you know, how do you distinguish yourself from the madman? You know, from someone that megalomaniac who you know, is some, you know, a delusional character suffering from, you know, the complexes of, you know, combination of ruthless ambition and, you know, ultimate sense of powerlessness, and, you know, kind of camouflages all that stuff in some psychosis. I mean, how do you not become one of those guys? And you know, the answer is that you constantly subjecting yourself to a discipline and an integrity and you know, a process of strengthening, you know, the psycho-spiritual being of oneself through these rigorous spiritual practices which Crowley taught. And, you know, as I said earlier, he taught meditation. He was the first teacher of magic, to my knowledge, who taught meditation and yoga as a form of developing spiritual strength as a magician. And that's just, you know, that's like awesome.
Yeah.
Because it means that our system allows a person to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. Meditation is some never-ending journey, and another part of this ever-expanding journey toward Godhead, you know? So the higher you become, the more powerful your magic is. And that's where Crowley, I think, really distinguished himself from all other magical teachers.
That was one of the surprising things. And again, I am a beyond, I don't even think neophyte's the right word for it, or something way before that. That was one of the things in book four that I remember reading and being pleasantly surprised by him advising yoga and meditation. It was so comforting because that's something that I have much more experience with than I do with magic, though I feel more drawn to magic a lot of the times than I do to a lot of that other stuff, just because it's so juicy. I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about what the OTO is.
Well, the OTO is a fraternal order. It's like a secret society, or, you know, it's not, it couldn't exactly be a secret society if you know
right.
What it's at, and I'm sitting here talking about it. it's a private special interest group is the way I tend to describe it, in which we study and practice the teachings of Aleister Crowley and the Book of the Law. It was originally founded by a group of German men somewhere around 1895 or so, and it was very, very closely affiliated with Masonry. The only way you could join was to be a Mason. But they admitted women, and that's where they broke from Masonry. And they believed in and studied a kind of tantric yoga sexual doctrine, and in addition to all of their other standard esoteric doctrines. And in about 1912, the head of the order came to Aleister Crowley and gave him the authority as the head of the English-speaking world. And Crowley began to incorporate the teachings of the Book of the Law, which he had received about 8 years earlier, into the rituals of the OTO. Crowley was a Mason, and Crowley had spent a lot of time studying all the world's religions and traveling throughout the world and being part of secret societies, you know, in India and Egypt and China. I mean, he was really and truly he was a prophet. He was a wandering prophet. And by 1912, he decided to use the OTO as a vehicle for the teachings of Thelema. So with Theodore Royce, who was the head of the order in Germany at that time, with his permission, Crowley revised the OTO rituals, which had been pretty Masonic in form, and turned them into something that was more in line with the teachings of the new eon and the Book of the Law. The Book of the Law announces a new eon, and the Book of the Law is really Crowley's spiritual authority. It's what established him as the prophet, established him as the teacher for this new religious and spiritual doctrine. And so OTO attempts to practice that and to teach it and to live it. And Crowley wrote a ritual a couple years later called the Gnostic Mass. And right now it's something that's being done worldwide by a number of groups in over 50 different countries. When I joined the OTO, there were maybe 12 members, including me. And, some of the members hadn't been heard from for a number of years. So it was really in its, you know, modern infancy. I mean, Crowley died in 1947. And when he died, he passed the OTO, or the leadership of the OTO, onto a man named Carl Germer. And Carl Germer had this kind of very, like, withdrawn personality. So under his leadership, the OTO began to die. And it wasn't really revived until 1969 by a man called Grady McMurtry, who was a student of Crowley's. He was actually knew Crowley, visited him in England during World War II, spent a lot of time with him, and received authorization from Crowley to take over the work of the order in case of an emergency. And in 1969, Grady perceived an emergency and activated the authorization that Crowley gave him. And I met Grady in 1976 and joined the OTO because of I had been studying Crowley for some years, and I certainly knew that the OTO was his group. But, you know, Grady's personal spiritual power, you know, brought me even closer to the order. So I
would you mind talking a little bit about what you mean when you say his personal spiritual power? What do you mean by that?
Well, Duncan, you know, the way this thing works, look, if you're a teacher, you've got to have something that gives me a sense that you have something I want to learn, that somehow or other you have developed certain skills or certain powers or certain knowledge or you know, a certain ethical reality that attracts me. You know, if you're some you know, if you don't have power, why would I seek you out? If you don't convey to me a sense of mastership, a sense of humor, you know, a sense of strength, spiritual, intellectual, and strength of character, you know, why would I come to you for spiritual teachings? I'm only going to come to someone who has characteristics that I seek in myself. And, you know, Grady was just a really personable guy, you know, and he was very abrupt and, you know, spoke really, really fast and all that kind of stuff. But he had a twinkle in his eye that just brought, you know, a certain sense of recognition, at least from me, you know, and he was not pretentious. He was very funny. He was, you know, he was very simple. He'd spent a lot of time in the military, so he understood, you know, the company of other people. He was very devoted to the OTO. He was also, there was an aspect of him that was extremely fierce, you know, and I think you felt it when you were in his presence. He didn't abide fools, and he didn't allow you, if you were there, to be an idiot. You knew that you had to be on your best behavior because he was very strict, you know. And
yes, I think that this is something I'm interested in. I don't know what it's. It seems like something science can't really measure. But from time to time, if you're lucky, you do come into contact with beings like that, and it's an interesting thing how they elicit their respect just naturally from people that so many other people just desperately try to get from the world. You get around them and you just immediately enter into this kind of, I don't know if reverence the right word, but something about certain people you get around, there's just no denying the fact that they are radiating some kind of energy that is contagious. I'm really curious to hear about this version of it, the way that it manifests in the world of magic, because I've seen the way it manifests in the world of like Eastern religion. And it's curious to hear this version of it. It sounds a little more stern, you know, it sounds a little more disciplined and more like something in that's akin to martial arts than the sort of loving guru. Though I've heard some gurus can be fierce too. Would you consider him your guru?
Well, I mean, he was absolutely my guru. And, fierceness, your perception of it as martial arts, I think, is just amazing. I think you're really accurate about
Thank
that.
You.
The OTO is structured as a military order. You know, what we say, what our mythos is that our order was derived from the Knights Templar, that we are a survival of the Knights Templar order. And, I'm not going to even begin to countenance the question of, like, well, do you really think we're, do you really think we're Templars? I mean, it's like, obviously not. I about as close to the workings of the inner side of the order as you can get. And I can tell you for sure, we don't have a paper signed by Jacques de Molay saying Wasserman is like, you know, part of the Templar order of 1307. So that's not what I mean. What I mean is that we embrace the model of the spiritual warrior, and we embrace the concept of the battle, you know, the quest for the Holy Grail, the sword and the spear and the constant interaction with chthonic forces that are trying to undermine life on Earth, and the the dragon, the concept of the spiritual warrior. You know, there's a sense of battle, and you know, it's the battle between good and evil. And I certainly believe I'm allied on the side of the good, and I feel that the good will triumph, but it will not triumph because I smile and am loving and sit around being waited on by a series of fools who aren't capable of rational decision making. It's going to win out because strong people will march forward and bring the message of liberty throughout the world, you know, and throughout all time.
I think that is a very realistic way to look at things. And you know, this is I'm working on kind of my own translation of the Bhagavad Gita, and I'm doing it, because I think that like it would be a great thing for me to read. I think my audience would like to, the people who listen to this podcast would probably like to hear the thing read, because a lot of them aren't familiar with it. But also I'm doing it so I can learn more about it. And this, what I love about it is that it is set in a battle. It's set on a battlefield, and it is the opposite of these positivity tyrants. Oh, peace and love. You know, a lot of people will kind of like bellow on and on about love, But what's behind it seems to be the opposite of love. But when you come into contact with disciplined people or martial artists or people who have been training to fight in whatever way that they have for their whole lives, they're quite often some of the most loving people you'll ever run into. And that's a paradox that I don't really understand, but that I like a lot. So that's cool to hear you say that. I understand what you say when you say it's a military order. And I don't think that that makes something bad. I think a lot of people hear that and right away they're like, peace. Well, I don't understand peace in the sense, I think that people's idea that there's some, I don't mean to keep going on here. I think that people's idea that there's some peaceful part of the universe that they're going to find is absolutely insane. And if you take a microscope, you know, you go to the most placid, serene, tranquil grove you can find with pans running through the woods, playing pan flutes and hummingbirds flying around your head, and put a microscope to your arm, and you'll find that your zillions of beings are trying to invade your body to kill you. You know?
Plus pan is the root word of panic, you know? And pan brought through that fear, that fear of dissolution, where, you know, the rational consciousness just no longer was sufficient to sustain the energy that you were experiencing, and madness resulted. So
wow.
It's another part of this, you know, this violence is something that is part and parcel of life. And as you say, there is no way to avoid it. There's no place so tranquil that you can avoid it. And that's why, you know, on a political level, all of this constant, you know, screeching around about guns as if you can't kill people with knives or rocks or bricks or boards, or, you know, you can also kill people by undermining their own personal power. You can kill them by turning them into psychological weaklings. And that is perhaps the greatest violence possible to take away a person's divine nature by making them believe that they're worthless.
Oh, yeah, or incapable of making their own decisions. You know, I just was reading this CNN, for whatever dumb reason, posted this anti-marijuana editorial, and the guy's weak, horrific reason for marijuana being illegal, or one of the points he made, which I wanted to vomit, was it's easier to just tell your kids that it's illegal. And I thought, what kind of shit dad are you? That's the way you're going to teach your kids that if the government says it's bad, it's bad. Or if the government says it's good, it's good. You're just creating little mini fascists that way. So, yeah, I know what you're saying there. It's a dangerous thing to brainwash people in that way. And I think the gun issue and all of that stuff does kind of point to this version of humanity that I don't really want to belong in, which is that the people aren't in control of themselves, which I guess some people are. It's a, you know what? I don't, as much as I think we could go on about the gun issue, because I'm a little conflicted about it, I want to ask you something that's, I'm dying to ask you, and I think a lot of people would like to know, I definitely would like to know, what advice can you give someone who is drawn towards practicing ceremonial magic?
Well, you know, the first thing I would do is I would read book four, which I know that, you know, you've been talking about a bunch here. The OTO put out a version of book four that is one volume. It's a big book. I was like 900 pages or something, but book four is actually part one, part two, part three, and part four. And part one is called yoga. Part two is called magic. Part three is called magic in theory and practice. And part four is called the equinox of the gods. And I helped edit a book, or I helped create a book called The Wiser Concise Guide to Aleister Crowley with Richard Kaczynski. That's Kaczynski. And Richard and I set the task for ourselves that we would give an introduction to the universe of Aleister Crowley that would help someone who had either no exposure to it or minimal exposure to it, but who had a burning desire to learn. And we give an overview of Crowley's teachings on yoga and magic. We give rituals that people can do, both in terms of, you know, magical rituals and in terms of what we called awareness rituals, things like, you know, before you eat, all the stuff that Crowley taught. We tried to compile his teachings in a central place and give extensive examples of his most important teachings from our point of view, at least, and to do so in a 128-page paperback book for $12.95. So
awesome.
Really looking for something, the way to, you know, get into Aleister Crowley, I'd go find The Wiser Concise Guide to Aleister Crowley. You can get it on Amazon and go for it. It'll give you at least a minimum of a year's worth of work.
Cool. I'll have that link on the page so people can get it. But someone listening now, like someone who wants to do something aside from reading or studying, is there a way that they could begin to access this holy guardian angel, this higher intelligence, this universal consciousness? What's something someone can do right now or today to move closer to this field of intelligence? I don't know what you would call it. God, I guess.
Well, Crowley spoke about the concept of inflicting yourself in prayer.
Can you say that again, please? It faded out for a second.
Crowley talked about the concept of inflaming oneself in prayer. And that's it's an old idea. You know, the idea is that you become consumed with love and desire and a sense of belief in the reality of a higher being, a higher power, God, and you just throw yourself totally at that in your mind, in your heart, and in your entire being, with no holding nothing back. Make an appeal to that. We call that higher power, the Holy Guardian Angel. Crowley called it the Holy Guardian Angel. Pray, reach out, scream, shout, you know, from your heart. You can do it silently. And say, I want to enter this path. I want to become an initiate. I want to be a magician. I will do anything that it takes to become that which I aspire to be. And I seek your help in doing that. And that would be the first step. And then simultaneously with that is you pledge yourself. You pledge your honor, you pledge your integrity, you pledge your life, you know, you pledge your fortune, you pledge your entire self to pursue this in a dogged manner with absolutely no variation. You know, now, of course, you're going to vary and you're going to fail at that, but that's what you have to pledge. You have to swear that you will do that. You know, and then you need to do some studying. I mean, obviously the easiest way to start also is meditation. You know, what you're going to do is, having made those pledges in that active form of prayer, in, you know, you can light a candle, you can burn some incense, you can set up an altar in your room and you can put a symbol of some kind of holy thing in front of you on that altar, and you can sort of direct your focus and energy into that and do all of that stuff, and then you sit quietly and try to feel if anything has changed. Try to listen to the voice of the angel and see if he's communicating with you, and see if there's something you can do to get closer. You know, keep your eyes closed, you know, let your consciousness flow into aspiration. We call this aspiration. It's the desire of the lower unto the higher. And you need to let that aspiration be pure, you know. You need to start living your life the right way. Okay, you can't be going every day to McDonald's and filling the temple of your body with junk food and garbage. You know, you can't be cheating in your business dealings. You can't be lazy at work. If you find a quarter, you know, if somebody gives you the wrong change, be honest. Give them the quarter back, you know.
Right.
To be a person of integrity. That's how you become a magician, and that's how you grow as a magician, and that's the only thing I can say.
Oh, that's saying so much. That's saying everything. I totally hear what you're saying too. It's it's an all-encompassing sacrifice. It's the sacrifice of your lower self on the altar of will to become your higher self. And God damn it, it's hard and it's terrifying, because there's the very strange thing about it is it seems that in the process of that, of a real part of yourself dies.
Yeah, the lower nature. I mean, what you're doing is you're declaring war on laziness. You're declaring war on sloppiness. You're declaring war on selfishness. You're declaring war on weakness. You know, part of you is going to say, oh, I just can't do this. It's too hard. And you're going to say, no, damn it. You know, do it. It's incredible. I feel such an incredible communication going on with you, because you really seem ripe for this teaching, just so ripe. And, you know, you can make contact with the OTO. There is a, website. It's something like usgl.org or oto.org or something. And, you can find out, it's in the book, the website and all that stuff. Actually, it's in my book, The Center of the Fire. And I actually have it here. www.oto-usa.org. And there's something called, www.oto.org for your international listeners. They can go to oto.org. For your American listeners, they can go to oto-.org. And you'll see maps of, let's say, where you're located geographically and what bodies and contact people are around you. And you can, you know, write to the order for guidance or contact, and you know, they'll help you get in touch with local people and stuff. So it's a pretty widespread organization now, and the most important book you can read is a book called The Book of the Law. That's also available on Amazon. It's like a paperback from Red Wheel Weiser, and it's about 120 pages also. It's like under $10 or something, and it's a red paperback with gold lettering on it, and it's got the Crowley's teaching on the, well, it's got the Book of the Law is the teaching that Crowley received and transmitted to human beings. And that's his highest teaching. It's very mysterious, and it's the source of the statement, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, and love is the law, love under will." It's the source of the statement, "Every man and every woman is a star." It's what we who have accepted Thelema call the sole rule and guide of our lives. Mm-hmm. So that's an important book to look at and study deeply.
Okay. I'm going to have all the links to that on the website. I think people are going to have questions for you. Do you teach this, or is there a way that people can connect with you? Is this something that you, it seems like you should be giving lectures everywhere about this?
Well, you originally contacted me because of the book In the Center of the Fire.
That's right.
That book is really a record of my experience in the OTO, in Thelema, and you know, before Thelema to some extent as well, just to give a sense of, you know, who I was before I learned about this this spiritual path. And I think that would be, you know, one way to really make contact. There's also, I am just in the process, I am about a week away from releasing a video on YouTube, which is going to be a lecture. I believe it's about 47 minutes. And it's a lecture that's about my book, In the Center of the Fire. And it's a much more intimate kind of look at things as well. And I have a couple of different websites, but the one that's most gives a lot, I put together a bunch of stuff on the book on a website called inthecenterofthefire.com. And that's a place to go for some videos and some early rituals that we found archival stuff. I've done a lot of writing. I think the way to meet me is through my books. I've written on the Knights Templar. I've written on the Bible, a book called The Temple of Solomon. And I've written on a number of different subjects. My books are featured at a website called jameswassermanbooks.com. And there's contact information there for people who want to speak to me directly, and I guess, you know, I'm willing to talk to people.
That's great. Oh man, I hope you don't regret saying that. but what I, you know, this has been incredible talking with you. I can't believe that an hour has already passed. I hope that one day you'll come back, because I have at least 10 more questions for you. Amazing, man. Very, very deep stuff. Thank you so much. I'm going to have links to you guys. The links will be at duncantrussell.com for the books mentioned, his websites, etc. So thank you very much for being on the show.
Well, Duncan, this has really been an honor and a pleasure for me. I feel that I've met a really kindred soul in talking with you.
The feeling's mutual.
Love to come back one of these days.
Excellent. Oh, thank you very much. Okay, you guys, this is Lil Hardin Armstrong singing Oriental Swing, which is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening. I love you guys. See you again soon. Hare Krishna.
Thank you. behind their peacock fans since they learned to say, yeah, man, let's swing it like the Melican swing, swing band. Swing little tune till the dawn comes in.